Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Ukraine addressed the UN's highest court on Monday, where it rejected Russia's claims that genocide has been committed in eastern oblasts as a grotesque lie. The International Court of Justice, ICJ, also heard urgent appeals from Kyiv's representatives to halt Russia's offensive, with claims that Russia had reduced the 1948 Genocide Convention to confetti. The development came on day 12 of the crisis in Ukraine, where cities have been surrounded by Russian forces and more than 1.5 million refugees have fled the country. In opening remarks to the World Court, Anton Kornievich, permanent representative of the President of Ukraine, insisted that the court had a responsibility to intervene.
Let us settle our dispute like civilized nations. Lay down your arms and put forward your evidence. Ukraine respects this court and follows its orders. Russia must as well.
Russia, which was absent from the proceedings, was due to respond to Ukraine's request on Tuesday. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet on Monday rounded on what she called the sharp reversal of achievements in Sudan after last October's military coup. Speaking at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said that the military takeover had again plunged the country into profound crisis and eroded 2 years of reform after the overthrow of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir. Thousands of people have continued to take to the streets in peaceful protests, but they're being met with live ammunition in clear breach of international law, Ms. Bachelet said. She noted that by late last week, credible medical sources reported that 85 people had been killed so far following disproportionate use of force by security forces during protests, including one woman and 11 children. Almost 300 million jobs could be created by plugging gaps in care services, the UN Labour Agency, ILO, said on Monday. According to the International Labour Organization, hundreds of millions of people who look after their families do not have adequate social protection. This included nearly 650 million women whose maternity cover does not provide 14 weeks minimum time off work on at least two-thirds of their previous earnings. Paid maternity leave or protection is a universal human and labour right, the ILO report insisted, but it found that 82 of the 185 countries that it surveyed did not meet these standards, and that at the current pace of reform, it will take at least 46 years to achieve minimum maternity leave rights in all countries. For men, more than 1.2 billion live in countries with no entitlement to paternity leave. And where there is paternity leave, it remains short, the ILO said, pointing to a global average of 9 days only. Transforming care policies and making them available to all would cost $5.4 trillion globally, the UN agency calculated, although some of this could be offset by an increase in tax revenue from the additional earnings and employment. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Log Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You've felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Democracy Now, well, at least yesterday's latest headlines.
And then Counterspin, hosted by Janine Jackson, as well as music and other things to fill out the first hour. The second hour will be with John Grant Live, and we encourage callers. Call in here on the second hour.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian and Ukrainian delegations are meeting today for a third time since the Russian invasion was launched 12 days ago. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned his people to expect more heavy bombing in cities as he took the international community to task for not doing more to stop Russia's deadly assault.
The audacity of the aggressor is a clear signal to the West that sanctions against Russia are not enough, because they didn't understand, did not feel, they did not see that the world is really determined, really determined, really determined to stop this war. You will not hide from this reality. You will not hide from new murders in Ukraine.
On Friday, Zelensky addressed U.S. lawmakers pleading for the creation of no-fly zone over Ukraine and harsher sanctions, including a ban on Russian oil and more military aid. The U.S. and NATO have rejected a no-fly zone, citing fears of further escalating the conflict with Russia. The U.S. and NATO are not directly involved in combat operations in Ukraine, but have delivered over 17,000 anti-tank weapons, including Javelin missiles, into Ukraine through bordering nations. The civilian death toll in Ukraine has topped 364, according to the UN, though the true toll could be much higher. Zelensky warned Sunday Russia is preparing to attack the key southwestern port city of Odessa, a city of 1 million. Russian missiles destroyed the international airport in the west-central city of Vinnytsia Sunday. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch says Russia uses cluster bombs in its assault on Kharkiv last week, which could amount to a war crime. A U.S. official said Sunday Russia had fired 600 missiles since the start of the invasion and has committed 95% of its combat power inside Ukraine. The city of Mariupol is under siege by Russian forces, and attempts to evacuate trapped civilians repeatedly failed over the weekend. Russia said it was creating evacuation corridors for fleeing civilians, but Kyiv slammed the plan for forcing people to leave via Russia or Belarus. Thousands are also fleeing Zaporizhia, where Russian forces are now commanding operations at Europe's largest nuclear plant after seizing it Friday. The number of Ukrainian refugees has now topped 1.5 million. This is a mother who fled to Poland with her children but had to leave her husband behind in Ukraine.
Now I feel safe, but I'm very depressed because my family was divided by war into parts, and I left my heart there in Ukraine.
Meanwhile, a group of prominent global civil rights lawyers filed a complaint with the UN on behalf of African refugees who face racist discrimination from authorities while trying to flee Ukraine. To see our interview with one of those refugees, you can go to democracynow.org. Back in Ukraine, residents of the Russian-occupied southern city of Kherson took to the streets Saturday to protest against Russian forces. Anti-war protests continued as well around the globe and in Russia. A local monitoring group says over 5,000 Russians were arrested by police across 69 Russian cities Sunday, bringing the total number of arrests to 13,000 since the start of the invasion. Meanwhile, Russia's crackdown on the press continues as Moscow passed a new law criminalizing reporting on the war and authorities blocking a number of independent online media outlets. Prominent independent newspaper Novaya Gazeta, whose editor Dmitry Muratov won the Nobel Peace Prize, said it was removing its reporting on the invasion because of censorship, but said it will continue to cover the war's effects on Russian society. Other news outlets, including CNN, ABC, CBS, Bloomberg, and BBC, also moved to limit their activity in Russia. Visa and MasterCard are also suspending operations in Russia. Meanwhile, a growing number of Russians are leaving the country, citing a fear of further crackdowns, including possible martial law and economic instability. In a direct address, the Ukrainian President Zelensky urged Russians to resist Putin's actions in Ukraine and at home.
Мы, украинцы, мы хотим мира.
We Ukrainians want peace. Citizens of Russia, for you, this is a struggle not only for peace in Ukraine. This is a fight for your country, for the best it had, for the freedom that you have seen, for the wealth that you have felt. If you keep silent now, only your poverty will speak for you later, and only repression will answer. Do not be silent.
Russian officials have confirmed the arrest last month of WNBA player Brittany Griner after authorities say they found vape cartridges containing cannabis oil in her luggage at an airport near Moscow. The charges Griner faces can carry a prison sentence of up to 10 years. Griner, who is African-American, is a two-time Olympic gold medalist and a seven-time WNBA All-Star. She's played for a Russian team for the past 7 years. Her wife, Cheryl Griner, said on social media they're fighting for Griner's release and return to the U.S. Over the weekend, the State Department issued a do not travel advisory to Russia and warned U.S. nationals the embassy in Moscow has limited power to assist citizens in Russia. In Washington, D.C., a federal appeals court has ordered the Biden administration to stop enforcing Title 42, the public health policy to expel asylum-seeking families with children back to countries where they face persecution or torture. The Biden administration is still allowed to use Title 42 to expel other asylum seekers without due process during the pandemic, but a three-judge panel questioned whether the policy, first invoked by former President Trump, is needed. In Mexico, a crime reporter was killed in the state of Zacatecas on Friday, becoming the country's seventh murdered journalist this year. Juan Carlos Muñoz worked for the outlet Testigo Minero and was a part-time taxi driver in order to make ends meet. Mexican journalists have been demanding the government of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador offer protection and end immunity for the ongoing spate of reporter killings. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian teenager Sunday at one of the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Local press identified the teen as 19-year-old Karim Jamal al-Khawazmi. He was at least the fourth Palestinian killed by Israeli forces in under a week. In Pakistan, the death toll from last Friday's bombing at a mosque in the northwestern city of Peshawar has risen to 56, with nearly 200 others wounded. The Islamic State's ISIS-K affiliate claimed responsibility for the attack on members of Pakistan's Shia Muslim minority. Hundreds of mourners joined the funeral prayers for the victims.
This is an insult to humanity. This is a disgrace to Islam. Those who have been martyred were humans. They were worshiping Allah inside the mosque, and they were killed brutally.
A top United Nations envoy is warning rival factions in Libya to agree to long-delayed elections after a parallel government claimed power in the northeastern city of Tobruk on Thursday. Stephanie Williams, the UN Special Advisor on Libya, called on the new Eastern government to form a joint committee with its rivals in Libya's capital, Tripoli, dedicated to reaching consensus on a constitutional framework for elections. Libya abandoned plans for presidential and parliamentary elections in December, and Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah has refused to cede power to an elected government. Aides to President Biden are discussing a possible visit to Saudi Arabia this spring to help repair relations and convince the kingdom to pump more oil. That's according to Axios, which reports the White House is scrambling to find new energy sources if the U.S. seeks to ban Russian oil imports. Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar reacted on Twitter, writing, quote, "Our response to Putin's immoral war shouldn't be to strengthen our relationship with the Saudis, who are currently causing the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen. Yemenis might not matter to some geopolitically, but their humanity should. This is a wildly immoral act," Ilhan Omar tweeted. Japan and South Korea say North Korea launched its ninth ballistic missile this year. Saturday's test comes just days ahead of South Korea's presidential election Wednesday. North Korea said the recent launches were part of tests to develop new reconnaissance satellite systems. Back in the U.S., New York City's ended a mask mandate for public schools, and patrons of restaurants, bars, and other indoor venues with no longer being required to show proof of vaccination. Mayor Eric Adams announced the steps Friday as daily coronavirus cases continued to fall far below record highs set in January, and after the CDC changed how it calculates the risk posed by the virus.
We are lifting the indoor mask requirements for DOE schools between K through 12 starting Monday, March 7th. And that is a great initiative. And I know there's some who state that they still want their children to wear their mask. You can.
Los Angeles also lifted its indoor mask mandate Friday. Meanwhile, a convoy of truckers opposed to pandemic public health measures has reached Washington, D.C., where they're planning a second consecutive day of protests, slowing down traffic on the Capitol Beltway. The U.S. Supreme Court's reinstated the death sentence of Jokhar Tsarnaev, who's serving life in prison for his role in the deadly 2013 Boston Marathon bombing that killed three people and injured hundreds. The Biden administration's enforcing a moratorium on the federal death penalty, and Tsarnaev's execution is unlikely to happen anytime soon. In labor news, journalists at outlets owned by Geo Media, including Gizmodo, The Root, and Jezebel, who went on strike last week, have reached a tentative deal on a new union contract. The agreement includes higher salary minimums for all positions, a guaranteed annual 3% raise, trans-inclusive health care, 15-week parental leave, and investment in diversity efforts and transparency in how newsrooms are run. In Iowa, seven people were killed, including two children, after at least three tornadoes swept through the state Saturday. Thunderstorms that triggered the tornadoes destroyed buildings, homes, and knocked down trees and power lines. And Vice President Kamala Harris joined civil rights leaders and activists in Selma, Alabama, Sunday to mark the 57th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when state troopers violently attacked black voting rights activists in Alabama as they attempted to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
In a moment of great uncertainty, those marchers pressed forward and they crossed. We must do the same. We must lock our arms and march forward. We will not let setbacks stop us. We know that honoring the legacy of those who marched then demands that we continue to push Congress to pass federal voting rights legislation.
Among those who spoke was Bishop William Barber. Vice President Harris was joined on a trip to Alabama by five cabinet members. After addressing the crowd, Harris, civil rights icons, lawmakers, and others linked arms to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Coming up, Deneen Jackson and Counterspin from FAIR, F-A-I-R, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, hosted by Deneen Jackson.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said recently, "Whenever I go to community meetings, it always comes up. Young and middle-aged and even some elderly. It tortures them." What was he talking about? Student loan debt. So, is what we call higher education an individual investment or a public good? The way news media talk about it could be decisive in terms of what we do about it. We'll hear from Braxton Brewington, press secretary and organizer at the group Debt Collective. Also on the show, maybe I'm a semanticist, but when media say there's a debate about transgender people's right to exist, I always think, well, trans people are going to exist. What's on the table is whether they get to live free from persecution, oppression, exclusion, and erasure. Texas state leadership is staking its position on that, but human beings everywhere are pushing back. And we'll talk about that with Andy Mara, Executive Director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. That's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. An NBC News story headlined, "White House Confronts Political Pressure to Extend Pause in Student Loan Payments Ahead of Midterms," represented much media focus on student loan debt, treating the fact that 45 million Americans owe some $1.7 trillion as an issue, an object of debate, a potential election factor. And that's all true. Student loan forgiveness was one of Biden's campaign promises. The federal pause on repayments is set to expire on May 1st, and what happens with it will have an effect on the president and the party. But of course, there's also a much broader and deeper conversation to be had about student loans and about debt that hopefully will carry us beyond any particular election cycle. For an update on the current situation and our understanding of what's at stake, we're joined now by Braxton Brewington, press secretary and organizer at the group Debt Collective, a membership-based union for debtors and allies. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Braxton Brewington.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Debt Collective is not just about student debt, but are there reasons for canceling student debt in particular among the constellations of debt that your work addresses, and or is this just a moment where there's energy behind student debt and its impact?
Well, there's a ton of energy behind student loan debt, which is now getting close to $2 trillion, the second highest household debt type behind mortgages, surpassing credit card and medical debt combined. And it's doubled in just the past decade as the cost of college has risen actually eight times faster than wages. So everyone from young people to even older borrowers are suffering grave consequences of crushing student loan debt. We're not able to purchase a home. We're having trouble starting a family or having kids, getting married. There's difficulty in just living a dignified life. It's crushing and it's dragging down our economy. And in this current moment, we now know that the president has actually the authority to broadly cancel federal student debt with an executive order. And so I think that knowledge is sort of aiding in the call for Biden to solve this crisis with just the flick of a pen. And also because, like you said, he ran on fulfilling this promise. So there's, you know, reason to suspect that Biden would take on student debt cancellation as a major issue because this is something that helped get him into office.
Well, there's a reason that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer co-wrote an op-ed with Derek Johnson, who's head of the NAACP, about this, because student debt plays a particular role in the lives and as you're saying, not just the education, but the lives of Black people, right?
Absolutely. Black Americans in particular, Black women in particular, are really bearing the brunt of the student debt crisis. 20 years after college, the average white borrower has paid off about 95% of their student loans, while the average Black borrower actually still owes about 95% of that student loan. And so 90% of Black students are forced to borrow federal dollars to even attend college. So we've actually largely closed this gap between Black and white students as to who attends college, but on the back end, Black Americans are having much more difficult time being able to pay off that loan. They're having to take out more because we've been stripped of generational wealth and more likely to go into default and face other type of life barriers and consequences to make it difficult to pay off that student debt. So Black Americans are particularly bearing the brunt of this crisis. And so, you know, that's why this is exactly a matter of racial justice.
And you're getting at what I think is so huge about this moment, the very idea that we're seriously considering canceling debt in the face of what you might call folk economics. You borrowed it, you owe it. That we're able to shift the frame of this conversation, I think, is very meaningful. Debt Collective talks about radical imagination. We have a society that orchestrates these situations in which to get a degree, you're told you have to incur a debt that then is going to maybe yoke you for the rest of your life. It's making it a societal issue rather than an individual issue. And that just seems major to me.
Yeah, there is this belief that student debtors and debtors in the 99% in particular have signed this. It goes beyond the piece of paper. We've signed a moral contract, right? That we have to, we are required morally to pay back this debt. But what we know is that sort of belief and ideology is not held for the 1% who walk away from their debts all the time. That ideology is not set for major corporations who have been bailed out in recent decades time and time again. And so what starts to become controversial is when the 99%, when working class Americans start to demand the same. And that is the ideology that we're up against. So many individuals believe that you took out this loan and this is something that you were supposed to pay back. The truth is so many people have actually paid it back and two times over, but because of skyrocketing interest and interest capitalization and all of the other evil mechanisms of finance capitalism, it's literally impossible to pay back. And so we're asking and demanding cancellation. And then, you know, we like to say that we are demanding abolition or cancellation, not forgiveness, because we have nothing to be sorry for. Because we have the audacity to go to college for folks to try to better themselves or to simply learn something that they're interested in, that is not justification for a lifetime of debt.
I love that language specificity. Forgiveness is something that someone more powerful is generously offering you, and that's not the frame that we're looking at.
Right.
I wonder, though, then how do you respond to the concern that cancellation without systemic reform is going to be insufficient, you know, or is it just like it's a piece of bigger things you want to happen?
Yes. Well, that's why we're calling for full student debt cancellation and free college. But the thing that makes it tough is for us to have free college, that's going to require legislation. And unfortunately, this Congress is having a tough time getting anything done today. So until we can get to that point, whenever that is, hopefully it's as soon as possible, what President Biden should do is cancel all student debt on his own. So this is not going to be the catch-all solution for higher education, but it's something he can do in the now. And what Biden could do is commit to saying, I'm going to cancel student debt at the end of every semester as long as I'm the president of the United States until Congress can get their act together and pass free college. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, canceling student debt is going to right the wrong of this nearly $2 trillion crisis, but it's not the long-term solution. The long-term solution is college for all, and that's what we're fighting for as well.
Well, finally, I have been a little bit surprised at the respect that corporate news media have given to the cancellation movement. I'm kind of surprised by it. It's a big paradigm shift. It doesn't necessarily look like reimagining the role of debt overall, so I'm just wary. I'm just wary of corporate media. And I wonder, what would you like to see more of or less of? What would help in terms of journalism, in terms of public understanding of student loan debt and the crisis of it?
I love this question. I think, one, there's too many things to name in a short amount of time, but one thing that we, you know, have been really trying to push in terms of dealing with corporate media is this understanding, you know, we at the Debt Collective use MMT framing, modern monetary theory, and this understanding that the federal government does not operate like a household budget,
right?
They have the means to do what is necessary if it's improving people's lives. And we see that with endless wars where we always have money to fight wars. And so one thing in particular with the student debt crisis that we've been struggling to get media and thereby then their readers to understand is that cancellation is not going to, you know, weigh deeply on taxpayers, which student debtors are taxpayers. In fact, canceling student debt is actually going to boost the economy. It's actually going to create millions of jobs over the next decade. And the reason that is because the student loans are money that has already gone out the door. And so there's often this conflation that $1.8 trillion in student debt means $1.8 trillion that's going to come out of the pockets of people. And that's actually not how debt cancellation works. In fact, the Debt Collective has bought and erase debt on our own through the secondary market. And what we know is debt literally is worth pennies on the dollar. So one thing that we're trying to push through is this idea that canceling student debt is going to then hurt the economy. The truth is student debt is what hurts the economy, and cancellation will improve the lives of everyone, whether you have student debt or not. You'll benefit from the housing market booming, people being able to afford rent, putting food on the table, taking care of their children, et cetera.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for that. We've been speaking with Braxton Brewington. He's organizer and press secretary at Debt Collective. You can follow their work online at debtcollective.org. Braxton Brewington, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton issued an opinion calling gender-affirming care for trans young people child abuse. The state's governor, Greg Abbott, doubled down, directing the Texas Department of Family and Planning Services to investigate parents who support their trans children in accessing care as child abusers. Abbott also suggested that teachers, doctors, nurses, anyone really could face criminal penalties if they don't report parents and providers who support trans kids. It's frustrating to read media accounts that say LGBTQ advocates disagreed with or were concerned about this event, you know, because actually pretty much every relevant medical and legal authority weighed in immediately to say not only do those statements not reflect the legal understanding of child abuse, but they fly in the face of the fact that support for gender-affirming medical procedures comes from, for instance, the American Medical Association, that states that not only is gender-affirming care appropriate, but that the absence of it leads to poor mental health outcomes. In the same week, Joe Biden told trans youth, "I will always have your back," in the State of the Union address. So here to help us contextualize this past week in trans news is Andy Mara, Executive Director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Andy Mara.
Thank you for having me, Janine.
Well, let's start with Texas. It seems important to say that laws don't have to change for people's lives to change, for people to be harmed. What do you think maybe what you're hearing from folks in Texas, but what are your concerns about the effect of these statements on people, whether or not they change the law?
Well, first thing that needs to be made clear, nothing said by Governor Abbott or the Attorney General in Texas has any legal basis whatsoever.
Right.
There hasn't been a court in Texas or a court anywhere in the country that has found gender-affirming care to be considered, quote-unquote, child abuse. It's just pure politics. And in light of the fact that Texas just concluded its primary, it seems pretty obvious that Governor Abbott was more than likely drumming up support amongst his base at the expense of transgender young children in our country and the parents who love them dearly.
I think for a lot of people, it's like a joke, you know, that you would say that parents who support their child are abusers and parents who abandon or deny or punish them, well, they're the healthy ones. But this is so obviously absurd and hateful that surely nothing will come of it. That's not really proven such a successful approach.
Look, it's not legally binding what Abbott and Paxton have both declared, but it is having a profound impact on our young people and their families. People in Texas, as a result of hearing the remarks and the actions taken, they might be afraid to bring their trans children to a doctor now, which is in no one's best interest. Medically necessary care should be accessible and should be determined by the patient and the healthcare provider. And unfortunately, the governor and the attorney general are sending the completely opposite message. And let's talk about the actual effects that this political rhetoric is having on our young people. You know, the Trevor Project, a partner of TILDEF, conducted a report, and they found 86% of LGBTQ young people in this country have said that recent politics have negatively impacted their well-being.
There's like 195 state bills proposed in 2022 alone, and it's just March, you know. So we're wrong to say this is ridiculous. Like, we do have to engage at every level to push back against these bills, even if they're just at a low level, even if they're just maybe not going to bubble up to become actual law, they still are having effect.
You make a great point about the volume of anti-trans bills that are cropping up in state legislatures across the country. 2021 was no exception. There was a similar number of anti-trans bills introduced in state legislatures, including in the state of Texas. And it's not a mistake. It is not a coincidence. What is happening is the result of a highly coordinated effort by a number of opponents who would seek to harm our young people in this country. Organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom and the Heritage Foundation, Concerned Women for America, these organizations have consistently attacked LGBTQ progress in this country. And their latest and greatest straw person happens to be young people. And not only is that despicable, it's quite frankly putting some of our most vulnerable people in this country at risk. We are putting trans young people in actual risk for their safety and for their well-being. And for parents, there is an incredible amount of fear and confusion about how they can best support their children during these times. So I just want to underscore, this is not a mistake. This is not a coincidence. This is a highly coordinated effort in an attempt to derail progress in this country. And sadly, for me, from in a very infuriating position, the next generation is being attacked, and it's downright despicable.
are there any particular things that you would like news media to do more of or maybe less of in terms of their reporting on trans issues and these predations on trans people's human rights?
First things first, we need to remember that these attacks are on children and their families. This isn't a trans rights issue. This is an infringement on the rights of families. And we also need to remember that when we talk about gender-affirming care, it's not some ambiguous, abstract concept. It is medically necessary life-saving care that is backed up by every major medical association in this country. We know that when trans people of all ages have access to gender-affirming care, it enables trans people to thrive. It improves their health and well-being. And I would encourage news outlets across the country to pay attention and to look for stories that explore more deeply about the positive and lasting impacts of healthcare. Politicians should not have the final say when it comes to who should receive medical care. That is completely up to a doctor. And for media outlets, as well as those of us who consume news, we have to remain skeptical of the political theater and the distraction from politicians like Governor Abbott and the Attorney General in Texas.
I hear that, and I also hear how crucial intersectionality is and how often that is missing from reporting, which tends to isolate issues and harms. You can be trans on Monday, but if you're also Black, well, we're going to do that story on Thursday, right? If you have a disability, well, that's Sunday. And I really appreciated Gabriel Arkell's senior counsel at TILDEF, who was reminding folks that things like organizations being allowed to use religious exemptions to deny services to LGBTQ people, that that's especially bad and differently bad for poor people and working class people because they're more likely to rely on services that wealthier people can avoid. And he also noted that, you know, if we're talking about child removal, actually genuinely taking kids out of families, well, that's a much more real threat for some families than for others. And so I know you know that you can't isolate issues. And if we're talking about responses, we have to talk about intersecting those responses. And this is as true for trans youth as it is for many other folks.
Absolutely. And on the matter of religious exemptions, look, in this country, we not only have civil rights protection, we also have religious exemptions as well. And both of those things have existed in this country for decades. And look, TILDEF is a proponent and a supporter of the Equality Act, which is a piece of federal legislation that would explicitly codify gender identity and sexual orientation as protected classes.
And Biden mentioned it, called it out last night.
Absolutely. And we know that with this bill and also the reality of the Senate composition, this is an issue that is going to require bipartisan support. And sadly, our opponents who do not want to see this crucial piece of legislation passed have twisted very longstanding and common sense principles like religious exemptions and distorted them to derail progress, and more specifically to derail the passage of this bill. So I would encourage listeners and particularly media outlets to delve even deeper on that particular subject because, look, our opponents are fighting tooth and nail to ensure that either progress is completely derailed or to slow it down to the fullest extent possible. And quite frankly, the trans community, but more broadly, the LGBTQ plus community, communities of color, communities of faith, would all benefit from this piece of legislation.
Well, let me just ask you finally, one of the things I liked about another piece I read from Gabriel Arkell was the reminder that courts, not even the Supreme Court, have the final say on an issue. The people do. And I think you've just touched on it, but if you could just say, where would you like to see people using their voice? It's easy to get discouraged when we see things like Governor Abbott and those statements, and it's easy to get confused about what actual impact that can have. And then even if it's not law, it still has an impact. What would you have listeners do to make their voices heard on this set of issues?
I have received numerous emails and phone calls over the past several days related to developments in Texas. And I have been on the phone for many hours with our colleagues on the ground. And a lot of folks are asking, what can I do in this moment? How can I be of help when it feels like there is nothing that can be done? And I would say, pick up your phone or go on your computer and call or contact your U.S. senator and call on them to pass the Equality Act. There is a crucial need for federal protections in this country that would not only strengthen existing civil rights laws in the United States, but would also expand them to include deeply marginalized community members. And for Tilda and for me as a trans woman of color, it matters when the president gets up in front of the world and delivers a State of the Union that calls on his colleagues in Congress to pass the Equality Act. That matters. And for listeners that are looking for one thing to do in support of trans equality, I would encourage you all to contact your U.S. senator right now and call on them to pass the Equality Act.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Andy Mara, Executive Director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. You can find and follow their work online at transgenderlegal.org. Thank you so much, Andy Mara, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you want to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Coming up in the top of the hour, John Grant live after this short musical interlude.
Desire to make you my own. I want to be loved by you, just you, and nobody else but you. I want to be loved by you alone.
I'd like to tell you a story about a young girl, about 18 years old, about 5 feet 2, and about to go out. Now, her mother, realizing it was her first time out with a young man, called her into the bedroom and said, "Minnie, you're all dressed up in your finery, your very best clothes, and you look beautiful. You're gorgeous. You're alluring."
"Looks well, baby."
"And now, Minnie, I want you to remember everything I've always told you, and above all, I want you to be very, very careful."
But she had to go and lose it at the after. She didn't take her mother's good advice. Now there aren't so many girls today who have one, and she'd never let it go for any price. They searched the place from penthouse to the cellar, in every room and underneath each bed. Once they thought they saw it lying on a pillow, but they found it belonged to someone else instead. But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. She didn't know exactly whom to blame, and she couldn't say just how or when she lost it. She only knew she had it when she came. They questioned all the bellboys and the porter. The chef appeared to be the guilty guy, and the doorman also acted quite suspicious. But he coyly said, "I'm sure it wasn't I." But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. It nearly killed her mother and her dad. Now they felt as bad about the thing as she did. After all, it was the only one she had. They just about completed all their searching when the chauffeur walked up with it in his hand. All they did was stand and gape. There was Minnie's sable cape, and she thought that she had lost it at the Astor.
But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Well, out your love is a honky-tonk parade. Well, out your love, it's a melody played in the penny arcade. It's a Bonham and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
gonna kiss myself goodbye. Oh, goodbye, goodbye. I'm gonna get my wings and fly.
That's Harry Roy and his Bat Boy Orchestra singing "I'm gonna kiss myself goodbye." It was a classic from England in late 1930s.
What are they called? The Fat Boy Orchestra or what?
Harry Roy and the Bat Boy Orchestra. And that's the name of that song, no shit.
El Gordo's.
I'm going to kiss myself goodbye. I'm sorry, I can't. And before, I got to do this, John. And then before that was, she lost it at the Astor, which is a hotel, I think, in London.
Right.
And then My Girl's Pussy. He was actually talking about his cat, but
right,
you know that from the song.
I know. So. That's like a woman I used to
Harry Lord
used to go in her apartment, and she had a bookcase, and on the book at the end of the bookcase, as you walk right in the door, it's about playing with cats. It says, "How to Play with Your Pussy." Okay, is that an invitation or what? But anyway,
it is something else. I mean, I just had to play some of that to put some light on the heavy subjects that's going on in the news. I'm sure what's on the front page of the what's going on? What is above the fold of the New York Times?
Okay, let's check it out here. Well, they've been having big headlines for a week or 2 weeks. And the big headline today is like, 48 points, I guess, or something. Desperation grows for trapped civilians. No food or heat for targets of onslaught. Pressures to ban Russian oil stocks sink. Military giant proves clumsy, rivals notice. Hate for Russia dark and deep boils in Ukraine. Walling off news from West, Putin claims a monopoly on truth. You know, and that's the whole front page, except for one story on, actually a positive story on the Supreme Court has made a decision in favor of Democrats in gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. So we got a good Supreme Court ruling. From North Carolina and Pennsylvania, gives Democrats, quote, a leg up in this year's election in two key states. So we won the round in gerrymandering here in Pennsylvania in the Supreme Court. That was good. Meanwhile, Putin's invasion of Ukraine continues apace and gets worse and worse. And, you know, major world mess, I guess you'd call it now.
Yeah, it's a mess, that's for sure. go ahead. I'm interested.
Well, in my case, I've been purposely stirring up discussions on several venues, which will remain anonymous at the moment. With various sort of friends and leftists and whatnot, with the idea of, what this is all about. A lot of people on the left want it to be about the United States. Obviously, people in Ukraine want it to be about the outrage of the invasion of their country. But many people in the American left sort of blow off that whole idea of the outrage of the invasion by saying it was, the various ways they approach it, but it's always the history of the United States and the outrages of the United States, the things the United States has done, always somehow ends up being the cause of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I guess my problem in all this, listening to all these various people, and actually they're saying, making the exact same argument that Tucker Carlson made on Fox News last night, which gets even more confusing. Again, I don't have any answers, but all I know is that there's a lot of strange bedfellow stuff going on here. And, you know, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, who's on first here, you know, at the moment. But,
I think everybody is in a way.
Right. I think everybody's that, you know, it's like a Tower of Babel we live in with the iPhones, and we're all just trying to figure out what the fuck is going on here, you know. Meanwhile, it just keeps going, you know, that's the thing. I look at it sometimes as a veteran for peace, in my case, that too often these things can settle down into a political struggle, political fights, so that one becomes a partisan in the belligerent in the process, you know, one of the belligerents. You're supporting one of the belligerents here. Whereas there's another side where you're only interested in, I don't want to sound too lofty or noble here, but you're interested in just trying to facilitate peace. In other words, just stop the killing and the destruction, and let's sit down and talk about, you know, the various grievances. Okay, Mr. Putin has grievances. What are they? Let's deal with them. Maybe NATO has been overbearing over the last decades. So, but, you know, you got to stop the killing first. That's my view, before anything like that can happen.
Yeah. Well, let's start out with
Yeah,
I agree. And, I mean, the propaganda salvos,
right,
from all sides are, I mean, first they say, okay, they're negotiating peace. Let's talk about that. Is there anything in the New York Times about the ongoing
They had some negotiations for humanitarian paths, I guess they called them, routes, you know, free zones, were paths where people could flee the country in safety. But the Ukrainians, the Russians offered these avenues of escape, or whatever they're calling them, free zones you can escape in. But the Ukrainians rejected it because, in their view, it was these corridors of escape led right into hostile territory, you know. In other words, they were giving Ukrainians a hostile escape, you know, a free escape route within Ukraine. But according to the Ukrainians, the end result of this corridor the Russians offered was putting them from the frying pan to the fire. In other words, they ended up in much more hostile territories. That was their claim, and so they rejected it. I don't know whether there's any more, you know, I guess the Ukrainians have met with the Russians in two instances. They sat across a table from each other, but, you know, I don't think they've accomplished too much. You know, and of course the United States is always there. It's always there like a giant vulture over the whole thing. You know, it's like, you know.
One of the negotiators was killed in his home.
Yeah.
Shot at the traitor and the Ukrainian.
Uh-huh.
And I believe it was. And they said he was a traitor. The Ukrainian.
Who shot him and said he was a traitor?
Security trooper.
Ukrainian
security service.
Well, they're playing hardball.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
They're playing real hardball. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And I don't know, the mainstream media in Kansas, out here, I mean,
mm-hmm.
people who don't have cable,
right.
you know, it was like they portrayed it that the Russians were agreed to set up the so-called humanitarian corridors,
right.
It would go into Russian territory. to go into.
Right, exactly.
I think it's Belarus or Belarus, Russia.
Belarus. Belarus.
In the north.
Belarus.
Yeah. Belarus. Belarus. And into the Donbass region up
right,
on,
exactly.
on the eastern side. And then
yeah,
and then
which,
and,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know if those are hostile territories, but I mean they're certainly not Poland and Romania, I know that. But
right,
to the west.
Exactly. I mean it didn't seem in other words, if we're fleeing the Russians, we're not going to, humanitarian corridor ourselves into Belarus or into your particular favorite eastern provinces that you've taken from Ukraine already. You know, I mean, that would be nuts. why would one do that? You know, I want to go to goddamn Poland, you know. I don't want to go to Belarus,
right.
You know. And so, you know, it's a game. It's a silly game that the Russians play.
Well, it's a game. Do you think it might be a game when you find the? I mean, I just last week I've been watching carefully the news out of England and Germany
uh-huh.
and France 24. YouTube has these services. It's sort of fantastic. Al Jazeera, you can get all
mm-hmm.
these 24 hours a day live streams. RT, sure. RT. Is on there, Russia TV or Russia Today,
mm-hmm.
and you can compare this news
right.
coverage. Is really, but one thing I noticed when they showed
mm-hmm.
refugees, which are now
yeah.
in the Biden administration, they're getting special entry,
right.
I don't know, permits, including their extended family coming
right.
in. Into the United States, there's been over, I guess, approaching, if not more than 1 million, I think it's at least 750,000 in Poland alone,
mm-hmm.
and coming into the, and what, I got to say this, and it's very subjective, it's not accurate
sure.
by any means, but I don't
right.
know why they film these people, when they film these people, all these people are grinning. I mean,
well, you know, I found that,
kids.
Well, here's the fact, I mean, you know, I've been in a couple of war zones, right? And in a war zone, if you're looking at it from the point of view of a person, middle-class American, sitting in their comfortable living room and whatnot, watching TV, on, you know, these days on a monstrous screen, and, of course, if it bleeds, it leads is the rule in the sensational news. So the news wants to get, you know, as close as it can to the action. You know, that's what Robert Capa, the famous photographer of World War II, said. You know, it's all the challenge of photographers to get as close as possible to gunfire without being killed, you know. So the story you get in your living room is always the flashpoints, you know, the really difficult, tragic, and bloody flashpoints of a war. Whereas really in a war, there are a lot of places where it's not happening. You know, you're not in the moment where you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're actually not there in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, and also I think you have to consider that Ukrainians are, because of experience over the decades, are quite a stoic people, you know. And so, yeah, this incongruous sort of smiling when we're looking at it as, oh, my God, this is such a horrific thing. And also, you know, when cameras are around, people tend to pose for the camera. There's a famous shot, I think it's by Ouija, the famous blood and guts photographer who would go around and photograph people shot on the streets of New York back in, God, the 30s and 20s maybe. Ouija. He had this incredible photograph of a cluster of people around a person who had drowned on, you know, beach in Jones Beach or something in New York area. And, you know, they were working on this person who I didn't make it, I think. But anyway, there's this woman who's looking at the camera. And she's just
yeah.
so tr- transfixed with the idea of having her picture taken that, you know, she is as delighted as one could be, you know. and it's so like, oh, my Lord, she's just been caught out. And it's a very human impulse. So I think, yeah, you know, and you see kids, they're, you know, get the attention from, you know, the news people. They like to focus on the kids. And the kids respond. It's positive. Just so they do. They look incongruously smiling and happy. So, you know, I think a lot of it is that kind of dynamic. You know, because well, as I've always, when I taught documentary photography, I always told people, look, most people who aren't photographers do not understand this fact. When you see a photograph and you say, wow, I like that expression, or I like this person looks comfortable, or in the opposite case, wow, this person really looks annoyed and angry, you know?
Right.
Well, because every photograph, especially a portrait, is a recording of a moment between, of a relationship, of a moment between two people, one with a camera, one without, you know? And we don't think about that. We think of a photograph as just coming out of nowhere, you know? But,
I'm not going to help you. I'm going to comment. I don't want to fucking help you, believe me. All right, so we do a show together. We have to do the mitt and muff or whatever routine.
Oh, well, you know, I'm ready. Give me your best shot, man.
Right, but listen, I think you've given a rare insight into. I think most members of the audience, including myself, have never thought about that. Because let me finish because I think you have more to say. I think you can have more to offer the audience and myself because I'm not a photographer. Mm-hmm. I never thought about this.
Right.
But I'll tell you what I did think, okay?
Uh-huh.
All these
uh-huh.
people last week, 1.5, now take this however it is, okay? Maybe
right.
I'm prejudiced.
Right.
I probably, you know.
Okay, well, that's, yeah, we need to be honest like
why
that.
Why are
yeah.
all these? I mean, why are all these people fucking smiling? You know,
right.
they're supposed to be refugees. They're, you know, they're
right.
fleeing, their homes being blown to smithereens, and maybe their menfolk are going to get killed, or the family
right.
they leave
right.
behind.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
this is, and I noticed they were young, you know, like 20 something
mm-hmm.
or maybe 30s, you know, usually with kids
right.
in tow. Well dressed, and I got more. I guess maybe I was getting steamed, you know, because I was getting steamed because you know they were well in
right.
good coats, and their kids
right.
were in full along carriages, and everybody had their
mm.
winter clothes on, and they were getting
right.
served food before they crossed the border and after they crossed the Polish border.
Well,
and
there you go.
I
think that's another reason right there. Yeah. You know, these people
well,
are being vetted. They're
coming.
Being
the
treated
coming.
Very well.
The question's yeah, the question's coming. Okay. And then I root around, and at first I thought, and I always think, well, this is a weird kind of propaganda. You know, I mean, it's like they're happy. And then I think, well, they're all coming. They're all like that old Neil Young or whatever his name, the musician, says, they're all coming to America. And then I got more.
Neil Diamond,
I think.
Thinking, yeah, maybe.
Neil, yeah, right on, brother. Neil Diamond, and I was like, well, maybe. I was like, well, my God, they're all coming to America. And then I get a news report,
yeah.
courtesy of Democracy Now!, and I've double-checked it with other, let's see, who else reported it? I think a BBC reported it. gave an interview with a black medical student from an African country
right.
who was
there
a medical
you go.
Student
yeah.
in
Right.
And he's saying it wasn't just when they showed some convincing video
right.
of students from African states being not only delayed but some beaten up and stalled at the same border. Okay, now that really threw me for a loop because I was like, wait a minute,
right.
you know, it's like what's going on here? And then you go to refugees. Nah, this is what I saw, and that was I'm sure it's propaganda also. From RT and the cameraman's filming mainly old people, old white people,
right.
leaving, and they don't have as good a coats on or anything. And they're leaving the Donbas area. And they and look, the Russian news media is the source. And I'm thinking, is this, you know, what's going on here? And it's like they're leaving. They look beraggled, tired, bitchy, typical old people, you know. And they're coming in, and they're just saying all kinds of nasty shit about the Ukrainian army. And I'm like going, what is going on? And then,
well, you know, I think
you're the cameraman. You're the guy that runs the camera. Then the last thing.
Okay, all right. There's this,
first, there was one about two days ago of this woman. They're both in camouflage uniforms. And this woman, we got a caller with her hand. We got several callers, by the way. And the one that just put their hand up.
Well, finish your thought there.
We'll get you on air in just a minute. But I want to finish and give John the question. John, the documentarian camera guy, a question. So then I see this one outfit getting flowers from another guy, from a guy, and then they kiss and get married. He's on his knees. He gives her the engagement ring, and there's people, camera people, running around him, some with their phone cameras, taking pictures of this woman and this man getting engaged on the battle lines, okay? And then, shazam, it becomes like a trend. I mean, I start seeing more and more different Ukrainian couples, getting engaged at the battle line. And all these pictures of people kissing each other as they separate. Right. I'm like going, this is like something out of World War II. Now, all right, you're the cameraman. I'm going to check out this caller and get him on the air.
Okay. Well,
audience,
you know.
What? I think someone's playing games, John.
I think you're. I understand that. I had a long conversation with somebody about the ideas of propaganda. You know, you see, because this is propaganda, that's propaganda. Well, in 2022, with the internet, the iPhone, social media, propaganda has become such a untenable sort of monstrous thing to talk about, because everything is propaganda if it's used in a certain way these days. You know, I read propaganda, a book called Propagandas in Plural, a Frenchman by Jacques Ellul, and he wrote it in 1965. I read it in the 70s. Excellent book. I highly recommend it still. But that was back in a simpler time. And even he says that, you know, propaganda doesn't have to be untrue. In fact, much of propaganda is absolutely true. It's not that it's lies. It's information that's skewed a certain way and how it's used and how other bits of information are willfully, you know, precluded from it and all that. It's the mix. It's not the whether it's fact or not fact, you know, and fake news and all that kind of stuff. But it's still, you know, it's such a massive tsunami of information these days coming at us from
it
all
is.
Directions. It's hard to really. This is why we desperately need to teach critical thinking from first grade to 12th grade, so that the kids and adults can understand the incredible challenge of information about what's garbage, what's not, what's useful, what's real, you know. But we don't, because we live in a culture that is dominated by marketing and advertising and all the horseshit written on the outside of the box, rather than a concern about, you know, what's inside the box, you know, what you're eating. And
right,
like
I want to give our
but
caller
go ahead.
A
let's move on.
He's Rick, but here I wanted to say, so the old adage of the camera does not lie, or there's a, you know, is sort of a putting the lie.
I still stand by that. Cameras don't lie; they distort with lenses, of course. But cameras don't lie; they are a recording of 1/25th of a second through a lens. But captions lie. Captions lie. You know?
Okay.
And as the montage measure that Eisenstein established, I think it was a Russian in the 20s, you know, with film, that if you take three images, individually they mean one thing, but if you juxtapose them together into a montage, it means something else. And so therefore you get into film and things like that. So it's very complicated, and Americans are I guess, swamped with all of it, you know.
Rick's on the air. Rick, you're on the air.
Yeah, how are you?
Thanks
for having me on, bud.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wanted to comment on the crossing of people where they're apparently there's videos of African citizens, citizens,
exactly.
African people crossing into Poland, mm-hmm. being accosted or whatever they want to say.
Right.
There's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Poland made a deal with Ukraine over about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And said if there does happen to be any kind of conflict with Russia, all Ukrainian citizens are welcome into Poland. That doesn't mean people with visas. That means Ukrainian citizens. So mm-hmm. when you have African people living in the Ukraine who
right.
don't have Ukrainian citizenship, they do not
right.
fall under that, so they do not get to cross. The deal was made over 3 years
right.
ago.
Well, I'm sure you're right, but it's not that in the cases that I heard, it wasn't that they weren't allowed to cross, it's just that they were kind of dissed and they were put to the side and they were made to wait till they were the last.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's like if I told you that you and your family can all come to my house for Thanksgiving,
right?
And then you show up with a bunch of strangers. Guess what?
Right.
I'm not letting them in.
Right.
That's
no, I hear you. I hear you, and I take your point. I take your point. The way I look at that story, and I've heard it for several days, and I'm sure it's true, is, you know, this whole affair is very, very complex and complicated. But people don't want it. People want things to be simple. The point is, there are racists in Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is, poor Ukraine is being picked on by the Russians. They're the good guys.
Oh, no,
on the
eastern side, they are the only Nazis left in the world.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the word Nazis and communists are pretty glibly applied all around these days, and I'm wary of that, you know. But
I
there are Nazis. I knew a woman in Belarus in during the war, and she housed.
If I say I don't like a Kevin Hart movie, I get called a Nazi.
I'm sorry, what?
I said if I don't like a Kevin Hart movie, I get called a Nazi. So
There you go. That's what I'm talking about exactly. That's in the realm of propaganda. It's a no good Nick word. You call somebody a Nazi, and therefore, you know, you can say anything else about them you want.
I got called a Klansman last year while I was wearing a Jimi Hendrix shirt.
Whoa, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Why does that make you a Klansman? I thought that would make you a fan of Jim Hendrix.
No, because the guy didn't see the back of my shirt. He just saw my bald head and my long goatee.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sure that's true. I mean, people, you know, are really glib and simple-minded in this stuff these days, and you have to watch out.
Well, people have to go for the quickest attack, and if it doesn't make any sense, go for the easy way out.
Right,
if it doesn't make any sense,
as long as
it's
certain, then it's good.
It's a bunch of guys trying to hit foul tips to get on base.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible, terrible mess, and the first casualty of war is always truth, and, you know, we're seeing that happen. And I mean, the idea that there are Nazis, you know, quote, Nazis in Ukraine. Well, there are Nazis in Russia. There's Nazis in the United States. There's Nazis, they're popping up like flowers, you know, everywhere these days. You know, this is the state of the world, you know. Nazis are coming out of the woodwork.
I would say there's probably about like 450 Nazis in the United States.
Right, but they make a lot of noise, you know.
No, they don't. They get accused. Everybody gets accused of being one, which makes them one. It's ridiculous. But now, on the eastern side of the Ukraine, we do know that there is a major Ukrainian attack on Russian citizens, calling them subhumans, calling them Asians. And they, you know, they're swastika waving guys. They really do. They do that in the Ukraine. But that's none of my beeswax.
Yeah.
I'm only talking about the attacks on African Ukrainians.
Yeah.
Who aren't Ukrainian citizens, and that's what I'm saying, is we need to stick to that subject. They do not, they're not allowed in Poland because Poland has a strict policy.
Well, my understanding is many of them, I don't know all of them, I don't know absolutely, but the ones that I heard interviewed, they said, yeah, they let us in, but they were just slow and they felt dissed.
They're not this. That's like saying, so me and you go to Six Flags Great Adventure, and we don't get on the rides as fast as the people who already have the fast pass. Well, they
that's
have the fast pass. That's the rule.
Yeah. Right.
That's how the rules are. Like if we go to if me and you go to BJ's or Sam's Club or Costco,
we
don't get to get in because we didn't pay to get in. It's not our right.
Okay.
Poland made a deal and said Ukrainian citizens with Ukrainian passports are allowed here in case of an emergency.
Right.
They wouldn't let them in before that. They would have delayed them just as much. They said, if there is a war, we will let you in right away.
Okay.
So,
fair enough. So what
I'm
is
sorry
your,
to say,
what
but Nigerians
your...
don't have Ukrainian passports.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, yeah, this is an unfortunate sort of messy thing. That's true. I mean, as I say, there are, you know, it's like we're shocked. There's racists in Ukraine. I mean, Christ. There's racists in Russia.
There's
racists in America.
Racism.
Oh, my God, I'm shocked. You know?
Well, it's white-on-white racism. It's fine.
Right.
Nobody's mad about that.
White-on-white racism. It's a mess, and these things are going to happen.
That's why I hate it being called racism. That I'm so sorry that Nigerians and or Ghanaians or people from Zimbabwe are being screwed over. But the deal was made between Poland and the Ukraine.
Right.
That's the deal. It's not personal. It's not about color. It's about we'll help Ukrainians.
Right.
We're not going to help random Joe
Schmo.
I want to shift gears
yeah, go ahead.
A little bit. So they made a deal. It just came through. What's his name? Ambassador Blinken. What a name, Blinken. He swung a deal over the weekend with Poland. To, if you can give your old MiG Soviet jet fighters to Ukraine to fight, and we'll bet, and he used the word, I thought this is very working class of him, and I'm being very glib, to use the word, and we will backfill you with U.S. jet fighters. I mean, this idea of dumping old Soviet arms began with Germany late last week, and I have the news clip, the audio clips I can play if you don't believe me. Deutsche Welle, German television, said, we're going to triple our military budget. Well, immediately that brought out at least a quarter million people in Berlin against against war. But he said, we're going to triple our military budget, and what we've come up with, what we can do is we can send I got the note right here. They're called Stellas, STELAS, shoulder-launched missiles for both tanks and aircraft. And there's about 2,700 of those old Soviet shoulder-launched missiles that we can ship to Ukraine immediately. So it's like caught on among the, if you ask me, it caught on among the NATO, the imperialistic people of NATO, to say, well, this isn't really breaking the law. We're giving the Soviets their own old arms back to the Ukrainians to shoot down their airplanes, their tanks. What do you think of that, you guys?
Well, in the green room, Malcolm Nance. Remember, you were talking about Malcolm. He said very publicly he knows where, you know, there are MiG-22s or whatever they are parked that could be, I guess, in Germany. that could be, sent to Ukraine, because there are pilots in Ukraine who fly MiG-22s. They know how to fly them. And I think that may be what you're referring to, yeah.
Not only that, but in Crimea, there was about, like three airplane hangars, well, three football fields of airplane hangars, stockpile of old weapons from the USSR. That's why the first thing that Russia went after was Crimea.
Right. Because
they knew that's where the weapons were.
Right, fair enough.
So now they're going to take back those weapons. We're going to hand them more old Russian weapons. Because, of course, like you just said, we're not going to give them the new ones.
Right.
We're going to,
Everything we're talking about.
Wait a minute. Let me get the word
okay,
right.
Go ahead.
We're going to backfill. What a word, backfill.
There's a lot of backfilling going on. Yeah, backfilling.
Yeah.
Instead of having an open mind, you decide what want, and then you backfill it with evidence.
No, not even that. When you want to put in a pool, you take out the bad dirt. You put in fresh sand.
I work.
That's backfill.
I work construction. By God, that word backfill comes from when I first heard it. When it comes to earth work, on an old job, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're 100% right. You're 100% right with earth moving. That's what backfilling is. You take out the bad dirt and you put in sand.
Well, that's the metaphor, yeah, backfilling. Yeah.
Blanket.
So we have countries now, which it disgusts me that Germany is even getting involved, because they need to shut the hell up. I'm sorry, you lost the last time, and now you're the worst, probably the worst country in the EU by far.
Now, why do you say that? You have to give us some reason for that. You can't just say the worst person in the world and not give us a reason.
I said worst country in the world.
Well, I know, I'm kidding.
The worst person in the world, unfortunately, is my president.
You don't like Joe Biden? Okay, here we go.
Second worst, Kamala Harris.
Oh, you don't like the vice president. I see, okay. Well, I am in quite a quandary, because I have written a number of articles really trashing Joe Biden for mass incarceration, et cetera, blah, 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 in bed with Strom Thurmond and all that kind of crap. But at the same time, I voted for him, and...
You voted for Joe Biden?
Yeah. Well, who else would I vote?
Were you not paying attention?
Huh?
Were you not paying attention at all?
You're very clever. But no, I voted for him because it's my choice.
I thought he was the better.
I don't like Donald Trump. Frankly, I would not vote for Donald Trump.
I could care less about Donald Trump.
Well, who did you vote for?
Donald Trump.
You did? Oh, okay.
Yeah, for the same reason I would vote for any angel against Satan.
Oh, cut it out, man. Come on. The words, boogeyman words. Let's try to be realistic in this.
How about this?
Obviously everybody
is imperfect. All right, hold on. Let me rephrase that. I would vote for David Lee Roth over I forgot her name. I had the joke ready.
Now, who's David Lee Roth? Tell me.
He was the lead singer for Van Halen.
Rock star. Okay, I got
you. Over that
Boyle, Susan Boyle. Who's a better singer, David Lee Roth or Susan Boyle? Susan Boyle.
I think I'd vote for Bob Dylan. He's a lousy singer, but I like him.
And Joe Biden is mentally challenged and dying.
We're all dying, pal. Come on.
Yeah, but not at the rate he is.
Hey, nobody gets out alive. And the moment, it's a struggle between life and living and dying from the moment the doctor hits you on the ass until they pull the sheet over your face,
Yeah,
I mean, we're all living and dying at the same moment.
Joe Biden can't even figure out a sentence. I got to be honest with you. I'd take Kanye.
Well, Kanye is, you know, bipolar. He's a whack job, yeah.
Yeah, but at least he knows how to form a sentence.
Not when I heard him the last time.
I'm voting for Mike Lindell. I'm on my pillow.
Oh, man, you're a comedian. That's what you are.
Guy. I'm going to vote for the pillow
my
guy.
My pillow. Okay, yeah. Well, my pillow, you know, I watch Fox News now, and he has, you know, every night it's like five ads for my pillow. He's crying in his beer about he's been canceled and all this, you know, a poor guy.
Guy
can't sell a goddamn pillow.
He's a former crackhead with a quarter
That's
billion
true.
Dollars.
That's true. I know.
He needs to shut up. I actually worked. I physically worked security for him in D.C. two Novembers ago.
Okay. I guess what I don't understand is you sound like a reasonable person, but then you vote
like
for Donald Trump. I mean, I don't understand.
I'm John. Hey, Rick. Let me just get something in, John and Rick. This is the quality I think that the left wing or whatever you want to call it. Anti-war people, to a certain extent, have lost.
Right.
You know, I think in the last 20 years, they've lost it. And I see that. I mean, I know people out here who voted for Trump who I'm friends with still. They're working their asses off and taking care of their kids and paying their mortgages
so hard
that I hardly get to see them. It's hard to get to have a beer in the garage with them. But one thing they like about Trump, And they liked him because he was such a snarky motherfucker. He's snarky.
True.
I mean, that's the only I think the snark is what people have liked.
I think you're right. They don't do that much research on.
Go ahead. All right,
it's
Rick,
not even that.
Ahead, Rick,
and I'll tell you right now. I'll admit you have my phone number. I'm a proud boy.
Okay.
I don't like Donald Trump.
Okay.
I think he's a bit of an asshole, and he did a lot financially for this country, but he really should have shut his damn mouth and been more diplomatic.
Well, he should have, yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. But
he might have been reelected if he'd been a lot smarter, yeah.
Well, but the opposition was so bad is the reason why he got elected in the first place, and why the reason why everybody hates what the Democrats are doing right now, because they're putting up, I mean, literally, I've never seen anybody dumber in my entire life than Joe Biden. I don't know if that exists.
Look, that is, we used to say that about Ronald Reagan, he's a dumb shit and all this, and senile, and George W. Bush was a deer in the headlights, dumb shit, and all this. But they weren't, these people weren't. Reagan and George Bush Jr. were not stupid people. I mean, come on. And Joe Biden is not by any means a stupid person.
Joe Biden just said that he's worried about Russia going into the Ukraine to attack the Iranian people. I mean, he said that those words.
Oh, well, I know.
You have to at least get the countries right. I don't want Trump. I don't want Biden. I'm a libertarian. I could care less.
Look at the Roosevelts. Teddy Roosevelt started out as a sickly kid, and he worked himself
now you're
up
talking
to
about
be Mr. Macho. And you had the other Roosevelt, of course, was in a wheelchair. But, you know, these people, they overcame obstacles, tremendous obstacles.
Oh, yes.
Well, the same way with Joe Biden started out stuttering. And he stutters now. You can see vestiges of it in the guy.
He started out in Congress as a racist and somehow is the president.
I'm not arguing with that, pal. I'm not arguing with that at all.
Yeah, so screw
that I've written about it. I'll send you my pieces. You know, I mean, yeah, exactly.
Let's get a libertarian. Let's get a constitutionalist in here at least.
If you think Donald Trump is a constitutionalist,
no, I do not want Trump back.
You're delusional.
I'm telling you. I said I voted for him. I voted for the lesser of two evils. I do not want him back.
Okay.
I don't ever want to see his face again.
Who would be a good candidate for you in 2024?
I'd say it's few and far between. I'm not opposed to DeSantis.
Okay.
Not opposed. I come from a Rand Paul, Ron Paul kind of
libertarian. You're libertarian.
Yes, absolutely.
I tell people, I'm a little provocative, I tell people that I'm a libertarian socialist. And they say, wait, what the fuck? You can't be a libertarian socialist.
Well, now hold on. I like that. Because
Noam Chomsky said he was a socialist libertarian. So, you know.
Well, no, I used to call myself an anarcho-capitalist.
Oh, there you go. Well, you understand the paradox, then, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We have to meet in the middle of the aisle.
Yeah. In other words, I'm a libertarian. You can smoke what you want, fuck whoever you like, pardon the expression. And you know, but at some point we need some kind of safety net, you know, and things like that.
Well, there has to be order.
Right, order.
For us to exist.
Right. We don't want anarchy and chaos. You're right.
Exactly. I like to call myself. I just got somebody introduced me to this word the other day. It's called an anarcho-constitutionalist.
Okay.
It's basically being a Christian Satanist.
Well, that resonates with me. I get it. Yeah, okay. Life is complicated.
There's logic in it. There's balance in that.
Well, yeah, as I say, libertarian socialist makes sense to me, yeah.
Absolutely, and
well,
I'm with
yeah.
it. Since Kanye's not running, I don't know who to vote for.
Well, I don't know what you're going to do if Kanye's not running. My God, man, we're just bereft of possibilities here.
I was looking to having a fully black president.
Well, you know, you get me going that, you know, of course, Barack Obama is not an African-American.
No, he's a Hawaiian.
That was good. That was good. No, you're good. That's very snarky. I like that. But he's Irish-African. He's as Irish as my wife.
You have to be born in the United States to become president. He's from Hawaii. I'll tell you this, but Hawaii is not a state.
Of course it's a state. What are you talking about?
No, they wear grass skirts there. Americans don't wear grass skirts, dude.
All right.
We have banjos and pickup trucks, man.
You know, I think we should all start smoking. We could have a real conversation.
I don't smoke, but I'll drink a beer with you.
Okay.
All right. I got a question. Now, I come from the fatherland of right wing. Some call it right wing libertarianism, which is Charles Koch and the Koch family in Wichita, and I've studied them a lot, and I've found it extremely interesting that the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statehood was seed funded with $100,000 matching bet between George Soros and Charles Koch to start that think tank, and now it's taking a prominent role in trying to mediate the situation in Ukraine. That's question one. What did you think of that marriage? That's factually based. George Soros and Koch giving seed money to the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
Ecumenical marriage.
Do you mind if I chime in on that first?
And then I'll be done here. And libertarians are supposed to be very anti-war. Don't you see the danger of nuclear war and this little affair going on in Ukraine? That's it.
Those are two questions. Well, yeah, as a libertarian, of course, the one thing that I love about the Libertarian Party, and I'm really just getting into it, so I'm not going to pretend to be an expert, but I do love the zero aggression policy and the following of the Constitution.
Yeah, and eliminate the drug war and things like that. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, all right.
our prison. Well, I'm going to quote who I think is going to be the president of the United States in the next 12 years. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave
Kanye,
Smith.
Not Kanye, huh?
No, Dave Smith.
Who?
Dave Smith.
Yeah, who's that?
I never heard of him, huh?
He's a former comedian, but now he runs the Mises Caucus.
Wow.
And if you ever watch his Smith,
I'll have to check him out. Yeah.
Just Dave Smith.
The Mises Caucus.
Dave Smith. Okay.
Yeah.
If Ukraine can elect a comedian, why can't we? Yeah.
Well, no, he was a backup dancer. I saw the videos of Zelensky. It's terrible.
You saw what?
But
what? Well,
You ever saw the videos of Zelensky dancing topless?
Yeah.
Wait, he's dancing topless? I mean,
he was
don't
like
men,
a boy band
that,
kind of thing.
I never
Rick,
thought
hey, Rick,
men could dance topless.
Rick,
I thought it was just had their shirt off. You know?
Yeah, well.
Hello.
Topless is the shorter way of saying it.
I'm trying to get the accurate translation, but the sitcom series, the comedy series that Zelensky starred in,
right,
was Party of the People. That's what I heard. That's how it was translated. And that's
right,
before he got elected. When he ran, then
right,
he got elected, you know, as Party of the People. Is there any truth to that? Do you know anything about that, Rick?
Yeah, of course I know about that. But I also do remember when he was a dancer who used to do all these weird, like, I'm going to say probably NSYNC, Backstreet Boys type stuff.
Mm-hmm. What does he mean? He was young, a teenager, dancing around like that? Or
no, he was in his late 20s, mid-20s, mm-hmm, in really good shape, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he seems in good shape, so yeah. So maybe, what, he I don't know. I'll have to check it out. Maybe there's videos of him, yeah.
No, there's 100%. Yeah, I see the videos every day. I watch them every night before I go to bed.
Okay. What's wrong with dancing? What's wrong with dancing?
Hold on. I'll put it this way as a quick joke. He's what my grandfather would have called a la-di-da.
Oh, you think he's lighting the loafers, you mean, or what?
I'm saying he floats across the floor.
He floats. Well, Fred Astaire, man, he was a very, very manly guy, you know.
Well, first of all, that Zelensky is no Fred Astaire.
Well, I wasn't suggesting he was, but you were making a case for dancing as a problem.
I think it's an issue from time to time.
Well, see, I see him as, you know, the people of Ukraine saw him play, you know, like, what's his name, Martin Sheen playing the president, and they decided, you know, I wish I had somebody like that, and then they elected him to do the job in real life.
So why don't we elect Charlie Sheen? Oh, yeah, because he's a bad dad.
I don't want Charlie Sheen. No, please, I don't want Charlie Sheen. But the point is, you know, Arthur Miller, the great playwright, wrote a little book on acting and politics that, you know, Ronald Reagan was not an anomaly being an actor. All presidents are actors, and you're basically saying that you don't like Joe Biden's acting style because he, you know, he stutters and things like that.
He can't read a cue card.
Well, FDR couldn't run the 50-yard dash, you know. Okay, but
he wasn't so stupid that he said that his presidency was under his vice president.
I don't know what that means.
Biden literally said, "I'm under Harris administration."
I give you credit for quoting Arthur Miller. I mean, he's the one man
I
know.
I do love it. Yeah. Well, at least we can all agree on that. Arthur Miller.
He fucked Marilyn Monroe and lived to tell about it. I mean, I got to give him credit.
Well, so did DeRocher.
I was going to say, and only like 82 other people have been able to do that.
Well, that's a real badge of honor, I guess.
Well, I mean, if you count Murderer's Row, yeah, it's probably about 102.
Here we go. Well, listen, is it Rick? Rick, is that your name? Yeah, it's been wonderful talking with you. You know, you.
Oh no, it's been an absolute pleasure, guys.
So at least you don't want Trump in 2024. You're done with Donald Trump.
I'm 100%. He needs to shut up and go golfing.
Okay, good. There you go. Of course.
That's your answer. That's your answer to everything. Tattoo it on your forehead. Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. The bomb's lost. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir. The bombs will always lose. Do you hear me, Lebowski?
Well, you know what? Maybe that's just your opinion, man.
Well, the Big Lebowski is our theme song here. Yeah.
All right, I love this show. You guys are amazing.
We'll talk to you some other time, maybe. Take care.
What do you play? What do you do this every week?
Oh, we do it every week at 2 o'clock Eastern time. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll be listening heavily.
Oh, okay. Take care.
All right. Love you guys. Take care.
Okay. Bye bye.
Take
care. All right.
Well, John.
Well, there you go. That was an interesting conversation.
Yeah,
whose phone is ringing?
Man, I'm really cool. That's cool. Yeah, the phone's ringing, buddy. You're gonna have to go. All right.
Okay. Take
care,
Mike.
See ya.